Hello and welcome back to the Journeymen Podcast. I'm Mark Reeves.
And I'm Joseph Corlett.
Join us as we travel from club to club, delve into the stories, tales and myths that have helped to define the ethos and identities of football clubs all around the world.
We'll look at the club history from all angles, whether it be the team's tactical styles, superstitious fan rituals or discussing the best players to grace the shirt.
From our base in Berlin, we aspire to give clubs of all sizes a platform to discuss their greatest triumphs and toughest heartbreaks.
We'll take you through fascinating untold stories with tales of heroes, villains, promotions, relegations and everything in between.
In this episode, we'll be continuing our Hamburg story from part one. If you've not given it a listen, go back and do it. Everything will make a lot more sense. And this time, you know, we'll be jumping through. We've got a big departure, a real golden era, and a very sadly historic relegation. And picking up from where we left off last time, Branko Zebic, a manager who laid these foundations for a great team, a great player, Kevin Keegan, was also nearing the exit.
So after HSV lost Branko Zebic, they were unfortunately just about to lose their big English star. Keegan had become an integral part of the team since his arrival and made himself a legend in Germany. He had won the Ballon d'Or again that year, and the HSV fans had christened him with the nickname Magic Mouse, or Mighty Mouse.
He'd even released his own single as well, Head Over Heels in Love. Hamburg, it seemed, had fallen in love with Keegan. just how it had with the four other young English musicians that had been there a few years before.
I'm not going to try and compare the single, Kevin Keegan's single, with the Beatles by any means, but it's got its own like ring.
I feel like John Lennon is turning in his grave right now.
After the 1978-79 season, Juventus, Real Madrid and the Washington Diplomats had tried to sign Keegan, offering him good terms, but he decided to see out his contract at Hamburg and try and win the European Cup.
Actually, like, after Juventus had made an offer or an approach, Keegan was sort of interested in it and was listening to what they had to say until his wife said, you can go to Italy, but I'm going home to England. So I think that sort of killed that one pretty quickly. He'd actually, as we heard before, when he signed, Keegan was quite the negotiator when it came to his appearance fees and all things like this. And he'd also got into his contracts a maximum transfer fee of $500,000 that would allow him to leave if anyone met that. And he would leave Hamburg for Southampton in the summer of 1980.
This at the time might sound a bit strange, but the idea of like a two-time Ballon d'Or winner at this point, moving to Southampton, is like still as strange as it sounds now as it did then as well, with Southampton manager Larry McNenemy arranging like a spontaneous press conference. The journalists were somewhat reluctant to attend what was, on a Monday, their day off. Larry only disclosed the meeting would revolve around someone who's going to play a big part in Southampton's future.
Like what you say, you've got to put this into context. When we're saying he was linked with Juventus, Real Madrid, this was literally the season before. So then for this random press conference that no one really knew what it was going to be about, what it was announcing, happened, and McNenemy, the Southampton manager, got all of the these horrid journalists in and everything. No one knew what he was going to say, what was going to happen, and all he said was, I've got a bit of a surprise for you lads.
And sure enough, the reporters were then left stunned as the reigning European Footballer of the Year, Kevin Keegan, just walked through the door with a smile on his face and, yeah, stunned the reporters with his iconic perb.
You always try and put it into like the context of like now, don't you? But I don't know. Just imagining like Steve Bruce calling a press conference at Newcastle and then like, I've got a surprise for you lads, and like Messi walks out or something. Like
Robert Lewandowski just rocking up at Crystal Palace.
Yeah. It's a strange one, very strange one. And I think the story behind it is even stranger, isn't it?
Very, very strange, because the seeds of this move were set like about the year prior to Keegan leaving, as he was already decided he wanted to move to a new challenge. The grueling training methods at HSV, as we've mentioned before, with Branko Zebic had taken effect, and he was a bit worried about whether or not he was going to burn out before hitting the age of 30.
He was close with senior people at the top of Southampton, which many people still found that strange, but I think Keegan just thought it was pretty normal, even though like the club had only just returned to the first division two seasons before. So it really is like a huge coup for Southampton. But yeah, like you say, this goes back quite a while before the move actually happened, and it's all to do with a light bulb, which it just gets stranger the more you delve into this story, isn't it?
So the Saints manager was like refurbing his new home in the 80s, and he was looking for the perfect interior designer. And at the time, they suggested like this light bulb that could only work at the top of his stairs or something. I don't know. Whatever you want, Saints manager McNenemy. And unfortunately, this light bulb was only manufactured in Hamburg.
only sold in Germany, specifically Hamburg. Also seems very straight. Like, I'm no expert on like light bulbs, but surely like B&Q or somewhere would have had something. But no, it was this specific one in Hamburg. So McMenemy used his connections, tracked down Keegan's phone number, and obviously he had a dark ulterior motive, like as proven when Keegan was unveiled for Southampton. But yeah, initially, I think he just called him up and said, next time you're coming back for England duty or to see the family, would you mind bringing me back one of these special light bulbs for above my staircase?
Keegan flew back ahead of time because of some England duty when they were due to play the Republic of Ireland and arranged to meet the Southampton manager for a little reason other than for the light bulb that the Southampton manager suggested.
Yeah, and it was all very cloak and dagger, secrecy, like dodgy little meeting, and they were trying to find a perfect place to meet without starting vicious rumours or anything. In the end, they found a house in Kensington, and McMenemy made the point of opening the front door to Keegan, with the guy who actually owned this house didn't even know what was going on in the other room, that basically the Southampton manager was trying to convince Kevin Keegan to sign for his club.
It was clearly apparent that he was trying to like woo Keegan to come to the South Coast, outlining the benefits of a move to Southampton. He suggested that he would be in charge of a good team, up-and-coming team, and it seemed that the forward was already convinced at this point.
I think the last thing McMenemy was expecting to hear, which came out of Keegan's mouth, was, have you got a contract?
There and then in this Kensington house.
McMenemy admits he nearly fell off his chair in surprise with how willing the Hamburg player was to come and play for him.
And then on top of all of this, this has led him to Southampton. The one thing that was eating away at Keegan was that he had, before he'd sat down with the manager, he'd forgotten the light bulb.
Which, it's all very strange, isn't it? Like, Keegan knew what was going on here.
McMenemy even just was like, to hell with the light, which I think, yeah, when you've just signed a two-time Ballon d'Or winner, you're going to be like, oh, sod the bloody interior design.
but maybe, like, this is a tactic he used, I don't know, when he signs other players. Like, yeah, actually, there's only this, like, kitchen counter I can only get in Madrid, Ronaldo. Like, do you know, it seems very dodgy, very well-written.
But despite Keegan leaving, the good times were about to just start kicking in for HSV. Despite losing, as we said, Keegan and Zabek, Gunter Netzlet nailed the next appointment, absolutely smashed it.
Ernst Happel would come into the club, and you see the success we just spoke about under Zabek, and you're thinking, God, this is really good. But it turns out this is only the foundations of what this group of players can achieve.
One Hamburg fan we managed to find proclaimed that he was like Pep Guardiola of the time, and Happel had already, to be honest, achieved huge successes before taking the helm at Hamburg. During his first job as manager at Den Haag in Holland, he developed them from being a relegation candidate to a title contender, and he even won the Dutch Cup with them in 1968.
And then he goes to Feyenoord, and in 1970 wins the European Cup, actually beating Celtic 2-1, which I'm sure Hamburg fans would love, thanks to a goal in extra time from Ove Kindvo in the final at the San Siro, and followed that up with winning the league as well.
He did have a relatively unspectacular stint at Sevilla, but then in his fourth job at Club Brugge, he turned them into one of the best teams in the world, winning three league titles on the bounce, 75, 76 and 77 seasons. And then did the Belgian double in the 76th season too.
Yeah, and he got them performing in Europe as well. He got them to a UEFA Cup final in 75, beating Hamburg along the way, quite strangely. And in a European Cup final in 77 as well. And they actually lost to Liverpool in both of those finals.
So in a more modern perspective, this is a little bit strange. But over the summer, he was allowed to manage Holland on the international stage as he guided them to the final of the 1978 World Cup, losing to the hosts Argentina 3-1 after extra time.
I feel like he's having a proper football manager career. This, it didn't seem real. Like, so then he goes to Standard Liège for 2 years, wins another Belgian Cup in 1981, beating Locker and Fornal in the final before he gets a call from Hamburg.
So funny enough, Hamburg had tried to get Happel before getting Zabek. Unfortunately, though, due to rules with the German FA at the time, he didn't have a German coaching license. And the German FA said that we have to protect the coaches that have obtained a license with us at the time.
So German, just like not letting Keegan win the Player of the Year award because he wasn't German as well. So they go on to sign Zabek instead, like we say, laid the foundations for the success to come. Happel also had talks with Real Madrid, but luckily for Hamburg, they were unsuccessful. In 1980, the German Football Association actually set a precedent by allowing Rinus Michels of FC Cologne a coaching license, which opened the door for Netzer to get a license for Happel. And here you go, he's in.
So after replacing Branko Zabek, Happel immediately introduced a pressing 4-3-3 system, which suited HSV perfectly at the time. Again, pressing 4-3-3 system feels very modern. Like, it feels like that's how nearly all teams play these days.
Obviously, it worked here because 1981-82 season, they win the league title with this system. He builds on that previous success, a second Bundesliga title, now in the cabinet, the Volkspark Stadium becoming a fortress, completely unbeaten at home throughout the league season.
Ernst, remarkably, also added an ageing Franz Beckenbauer to his squad as he returned to Germany after spending 3 years playing in the USA for New York Cosmos.
It's quite weird, actually, thinking back to when they had Horst Blankenberg, the guy who could never get in the Germany team because of Beckenbauer, who they shipped out to get Keegan in, and now Beckenbauer's here, which is all a bit strange. But yeah, been away for 3 years. He comes back to Hamburg, sort of like the twilight of his career, and wins his fifth German league title. It's not a bad way to sort of bow out, is it?
That season, HSV scored 95 goals in 34 league games, many of them coming from the creativity of McGath, who served Horst Hubrisch so beautifully, as he was nicknamed then, the header beast, as he netted 27 times to become Germany's top scorer that year.
There's German wordsmiths again then. The header beast. Yeah, so the duo combined to score the goal that ended Bayern's challenge in late April, with Hamburg and Bayern battling through the top spot all season. So it's 24th April 1982 in Munich. Bayern lead 3-1 till the 68th minute, and this result would have meant they were only 1 point behind Hamburg. But then Thomas van Heessen and Horst Hubrisch equalise, and in the 90th minute, Hubrisch again headed a McGath free kick, the heading beast, into the net, 4-3, and this gives Hamburg a 5-point lead at the top.
Hamburg topped the table 3 points ahead of FC Köln with a huge plus 50 goal difference. That's huge.
Massive. And they went unbeaten between the 16th of January 1982 and the 29th of January 1983. You realise what a well-oiled winning machine this team was. That run stretched across 36 games and actually remained a Bundesliga record until November 2013, when of course it was beaten by Bayern Munich, which is boring. It's more impressive back then, isn't it?
Yeah. HSV in that season also reached the UEFA Cup final. In the first leg of the final, however, Happel's team lost 1-0 away at IFK Gothenburg, managed by Sven-Goran Eriksson, of all people.
I always find weird things, because obviously I don't know what I thought in my head. Obviously I know he's an old guy, but when he's cropping up in like the 80s managing like Gothenburg, it's just weird, like my childhood memories of him messing around with that great England team.
This is the reason why we want to do this podcast, is because it's amazing looking back and seeing these stories, just seeing where names like Sven-Goran Eriksson pop up. But hey,
it's like last episode when Mike Phelan and David Beckham shared a pitch during their playing careers, which I just found very odd.
But unfortunately, HSV also lost 3-0 at home, and the UEFA Cup went back to the Swedish port city.
Yeah, but I think this would all be redeemed the following year.
Und ein Foul von Beiner an Rubesch. Dieses Foul wird von Schiedsrichter Werner Vöckler mit der gelben Karte bestraft und ein Freistoß. Magath und Rubesch ist wieder da. 4-3, das war die Entscheidung.
As we move into the Hamburg season, 1982-83, a league and European Cup double. Hamburg once again went completely undefeated at home that season, but it was a matter of goal difference that handed them the title ahead of their Nord Derby rivals, Werder Bremen. Werder Bremen had a 38 plus goal difference and the Redshirts plus 46.
I feel obviously with the rivalry there, Werder Bremen, they'll probably be like, oh yeah, you know, we're unlucky. But Hamburg did top the table since week 15 and didn't drop from that spot for the rest of the season. So even though it was on goal difference, I think it was deserved.
Horst Hubrisch, the header beast again, getting himself another 18 goals that season as well. But the real story of the season was their famous European campaign. It began with an all-German affair, funny enough, as Hamburg faced off against champions of the communist East, BFC Dynamo Berlin, winning 3-1 over two legs. Funny enough, the stadium's about 5 kilometres away from where we're recording this?
Yeah, very close, yeah. And Hamburg's destination was the final set at the Olympic Stadium in Athens. En route, they'd already visited the same stadium, crushing Olympiakos 5-0 on aggregate in the second round. And they'd also beaten Dynamo Kiev and Real Sociedad.
Again, as we mentioned earlier on in the podcast, the type of names, don't get me wrong, a bit more European than Burnley and Cardiff. But again, you don't hear Dynamo Kiev's. You don't hear of like Real Sociedad's anymore. It's such good stuff.
And St. Johnston.
Again, oh yeah, of course. Don't want to forget them.
But yeah, it was Juventus who they would meet in the final. And Juventus' team had a total of 6 players from Italy's 82 World Cup winning team, including Dino Zoff and Paolo Rossi, who'd won the Golden Boot with the World Cup in Spain just a year before.
And that's not to mention the foreign World Cup stars, like the French midfielder Michel Platini and powerful Polish striker Zbigniew Boniek.
But yeah, Happel had become sort of an expert in beating Italian teams in the European Cup. As a coach of Feyenoord in 1970, he'd beaten AC Milan on the way to winning it. 1976, in charge of Bruges, he knocked out Roma before sending Juventus home 2 years later. And as the coach of the Dutch national team, he'd actually already beaten Italy on the way to the World Cup final in Argentina in 1978.
Although Hamburg had to contest with the pressure of losing two prior European finals, Happel switched things up. He moved to a more asymmetric formation for the contest with Juve. Most notably, Lars Bastrup was switched from the left to the right to pin down Antonio Cabrini. Claudio Gentile followed Bastrup under strict instruction from Giovanni Trapattoni to man-mark the Dane.
And that's another one coming out. Like, Trapattoni, I think he really... I just remember him as, like, island manager. But I think he was about 80 then. Yeah. So it makes sense that he was around in these days. Just 8 minutes on the clock, playing on the left of midfield, McGath took a pass from Jürgen Groer and approached Zoff's area. Juve's Roberto Betrega jumped to block a shot that didn't come. McGath then strolled past him, and after a step over, he let rip an absolute screamer from just outside the box into the top corner. That man again, McGath.
English commentator Barry Davis proclaimed, "Dino Zoff, he didn't even smell it," magically.
And this 1-0 scoreline sort of left the final on a knife edge, and Trapattoni's side really started going at Hamburg at the start of the second half.
Paolo Rossi had a bit of an off day and was very ineffective, not just from lack of service, but also getting caught off on more than one occasion by the Hamburg defence. In fact, Trapattoni ended up just subbing him off 11 minutes into the second half. Big decision there from Trapattoni.
Not happy. I mean, it's no Mourinho subbing off Glenn Johnson at Chelsea in the first half, but it must have had a bit of a stinker. Yeah, and the Hamburg goalkeeper was forced to make a few saves, but it just wasn't to be for Juventus. And the final whistle, Hamburg had absorbed everything and the champions of Europe.
I think this is the Germans doing Catenaccio back to the back to Juventus.
And all for a moment of pure inspiration from McGath, who they'd, you know, like we said a few years ago, got from a tiny little team, Saarbrücken, and now he's won the European Cup.
Hamburg had broken 6 years of English domination over the European title. Liverpool at that time had won it three times, Nottingham Forest twice, as we've already come to before, and Aston Villa once as well.
It's crazy that England had locked it out for 6 years in a row. Happel had become the first manager, still the only manager, to reach the European Cup final with three different teams. So Feyenoord 1970, Bruges 1978, and Hamburg in 1982.
Throw. Magath. Could have a try. He threatened to and then hit it. Well, what a beautiful goal! A lovely dummy at the start, which certainly caught the Juventus defence. And we have an early goal in the 8th minute. Fine play by Felix Magath. That was a dummy, a jump from Bettiger, and Dino Zoff did not smell it.
The Hamburg team, featuring Felix Magath and co, had thrived in Hamburg's most glorious season, passing them on to a European and Bundesliga double.
Yeah, and he was absolutely essential to Hamburg's sort of golden age that we're going through now. Maybe less appreciated than Happel, Rubic and Kaltz or Keegan, maybe, but definitely a talisman for this team.
He was virtually ever present in the league from the time that the Austrian took over, playing in part of 157 games out of 170 Bundesliga matches from 1981 to his retirement in 1986.
Through it all, he just absolutely bossed that middle and midfield. I think our sort of era, obviously, the only thing we really know him from is when he was manager of Fulham, and which didn't go too well, but obviously he was a fantastic player.
Felix had been plucked, as mentioned before, from Saarbrücken in the second tier, where he'd helped them win the league as well. He'd scored regularly from an advanced position for Saarbrücken, but then upon joining Hamburg in the 1976 season under Kuno Klotzler, he was pulled back into a slightly deeper role.
He quickly became the basis and foundations of Klotzer's side. And with his performances that year, he was rewarded with a call-up to the West German national team. 2 months later, he gets the goal that wins Hamburg the Cup Winners' Cup and the first of many finals that he goes on to appear, obviously. You could say it wasn't until the installation of Happel, like we say, as manager, this is when McGath's game truly sort of took a big jump, that he sort of took that good player to, you could say, a world-class player.
Hamburg were unquestionably Germany's best side, and Felix Magath had been a pioneering player and part of this team under three separate managers and been incredibly successful under all of them. And he was arguably their best player, most consistent player too.
Felix actually says that Zabek was actually the most important person in his career. He said that, like Branko, he'd always aspired to develop teams through hard work and dedication. And this, I think, is what shaped him as a manager after his playing career.
He did an amazing job leading Wolfsburg to the Bundesliga title in 2008-09, pairing an amazing strike duo of Brazilian Graffiti and Bosnian Edin Dzeko as they combined to net 54 goals throughout the season.
Yeah, and then with Musimovic behind them with 20 assists as well. It was just a ridiculous team.
Funny enough, in that season as well, Bayern Munich would draw 2-2 with Hamburg on the opening day, which then, come the end of the season, Felix Magath's Wolfsburg team would finish 2 points ahead of Bayern Munich. So, did Hamburg hand Wolfsburg the title?
I think it was written in the stars there to help out Magath, I think. He finished that up with a second place finish with Schalke in the following year, which seems crazy to say this year, a few weeks after their relegation to the second division, but was sacked in March 2011 despite having a 53% win ratio.
But no less than 48 hours later, he would return back to Wolfsburg, who were now relegation threatened. He steered the club to safety, avoiding the relegation playoff by 2 points, and then would achieve a mid-table finish, so securing them in the Bundesliga once again. But then after a slow start in the following season, he was let go via mutual consent, maybe a run the race, so to speak, at Wolfsburg.
Yeah, and then he goes a couple of years without a job until he crops up at Fulham, his first job outside of Germany. At this point, he's rescued a couple of clubs from relegation. Fulham are in the relegation zone, got 12 matches to go, and he comes in to hopefully keep them in the Premier League.
Fulham played their first match under Magath on the 22nd of February in 2014. The match ended in a 1-1 draw with Askan Dijega, Magath's former player at Wolfsburg, being the first Fulham goalscorer for Felix.
Yeah, but sadly, just a few months later, May 2014, Fulham are relegated from the Premier League after a 4-1 loss to Stoke City. Magath believed that he was the right man to stay at Fulham and try and win immediate promotion back to the Premier League, but he started the 14-15 season with four consecutive losses to Ipswich, Millwall, Wolves and Derby.
Magath, on the 18th of September in 2014, was sacked as Fulham manager after a run of 11 league games without a win. Ouch. He finished with a record of just 4 wins, 4 draws and 12 losses.
Quite sad, really, isn't it? And it gets a bit weirder of some of the stories that came out after he'd left the club. One of them that I remember was quite a bit at the time is that he'd suggested that Brede Hangeland, their Norwegian centre-back, should rub cheese on his thigh injury.
However, Magath would like retort at these claims, and he stated that Hangeland didn't have a thigh injury, but in fact an inflammation of the knee. And he suggested the additional use of an alternative treatment with a bandage dressed with the consistency of cork.
Yeah, so Magath saying, actually, hang on, let me stop you there. It wasn't his thigh, it was his knee, and it wasn't cheese, it was a soft goat's cheese that you only get in Germany.
It's a little bit unfortunate when you hear stories like this and you think of his playing career, because amongst people in England, he should be held in such a higher regard, in my opinion anyway. His playing career is undoubtedly just magnificent.
So I was almost going to say then, because you're a great player, doesn't mean you're always going to be a great manager, but he did do great things, like he won the Bundesliga at Wolfsburg. Obviously, the Fulham thing was probably, it was pretty doomed when he got on board anyway. And his first job in 2 years and his first job outside of Germany.
And I feel like the first job in England, where I feel like the press in England are just like an extra level of like intensity when you are stuck in a relegation battle at the time. It just makes for the situation that ended up happening for poor Felix.
He, an Italian, presents it to the captain of the successful German team, Horst Rubesch. And here he is, the man who decided this year's European Cup final, won for Hamburg by the goal scored in the 8th minute by Felix Magath.
So after a golden era season, a season to tell the tales of for years and years later, they would follow this up with an unfortunate run of luck where they ended up being runners-up in everything they contested. Literally everything. They competed for 5 trophies and ended up being runners-up in everything.
The 82-83 season sort of proved as best as it was going to get for Hamburg, and with Hrubesch leaving to go to Standard Liège, sadly. Early in the season, they'd lose the European Super Cup to Alex Ferguson's Aberdeen, 2-0 over 2 legs. And also they lost in the final of the Intercontinental Cup, today's World Club Cup, in Tokyo to Gremio 2-1.
Hamburg had a bye into the second round of the European Cup because they were the title holders, but they were thumped out at their first round in the first time of asking by Dynamo Bucharest, losing 3-0 away, and even a 3-2 win at home couldn't stop them being dumped out as defending champions.
Not a good start to this season, is it, going on there? But they did domestically take part in a great title fight, but just fell short thanks to Stuttgart's superior goal difference. And actually on the 33rd match day, Stuttgart had beaten Werder Bremen, while Hamburg had been level on points until then, actually lose their home match against Frankfurt 2-0.
On the last match day, Stuttgart played its last home game against Hamburg. Hamburg won 1-0 and remained second, but the first three clubs, Stuttgart, Hamburg and Mönchengladbach, were all level on points and only separated by goal difference, with Bayern Munich just 1 point behind all those three as well.
What a title battle. It's absolutely incredible. Stuttgart would also frustrate Hamburg in the last 16 of the DFB Cup, winning a replay after a 1-1 draw, 4-3. So they'd actually played for five titles and not won any. Coach Happel spoke of a lost year.
They slumped to fifth place the following season in 84-85 and then seventh in the 85-86 season as well.
As we see like this decline sort of happening now, Günter Netzer leaves his position at Hamburg at the end of the 85-86 season.
It's something that didn't really seem to come up too much in like the research about their kind of downfall from this golden era. Just didn't really seem to get mentioned, which was a bit strange in my opinion.
Yeah, you think there must be perhaps some correlation there, like considering his great managerial appointments and the turnaround of the club while he was there.
The only other honour won during this time was the 1987 DFB Pokal beating Stuttgarter Kickers 3-1 in the final.
Yeah, and that was sort of the final flourish of the Happel era, really. Runners-up in the Bundesliga that season as well. They're actually only beaten by the eventual champions at home all season, but finished 6 points behind Bayern Munich, the eventual champions. Happel said in his final year, "I will always be associated with HSV because I was able to work here in an undisturbed and professional manner."
Feels very Pep, that statement, I feel. Yeah. As Ernst left the club, the era did come to an end. He'd come in, built on the previous success here by Branko Zabek and Kuno Klotzler, brought two Bundesliga titles, one European Cup and one DFB Pokal.
Yeah, and it's crazy to think that Pokal win would be the last sort of meaningful silverware for 15 years. And little did the Hamburg fans know that this would actually be their highest finishing position until now. Like, they've not beaten it since.
Yeah, they've never climbed higher than third since Ernest Happel left the club.
And the following years sort of see the team slide into sort of mediocrity between like 1989-90 season, 96-97. They only actually reached the UEFA Cup places twice. It's a real change of form, isn't it, from the machine they were just a few years ago.
After these stable and successful figures of Ernst Happel and Günter Netzler had left the club, this really kicked the turnover and staff into overgear.
Happel's replacement, the Yugoslavian Josip Skoblar, only lasted 4 months. And to put the whole thing into context, Happel guided the club for 6 years. And then the following 6 years, they had five different managers, none of which producing any real measurable success.
On top of that, they did replace Günter Netzler with club legend Felix Magath. But he only lasted 2 years. Then in the following decade, they had seven different people take that role that Günter Netzler had just pioneered.
Before, when they're having this success, they have the stability of, you know, a very good manager, a very good, we would call a director of football role. Like you said, five different managers in 6 years, seven different directors. It's all a bit crazy, isn't it?
Hamburg's drought for silverware would come to an end 30 years after winning the first edition of the Liga Pokal. They would win in 2003 the Liga Pokal again, beating Borussia Dortmund 4-2.
This is where we come to some names we'll all know and remember and look on fondly. Just looking at the teams playing on that night, Dortmund's team, you've got Wiedenfeller in goal, but then Thomas Rosicki, Jan Koller, future Hamburg player and West Ham player Guy Demel, but also a shout out to a substitute that night, David Adonkor, German international, and of course Football Manager legend with like 20 pace, who would just tear everything up.
Hamburg had their very own future Premier League right back that night as well, with Lars Jakobsen, who would end up playing for Everton, Blackburn and West Ham.
Also playing for Hamburg that night was Mehdi Madavikia, an Iranian international who had become quite a hero at Hamburg.
He started his career with a breakout season for Iranian club Persepolis, before an eye-catching performance for Iran at the World Cup in 1998, which saw him score the winner in a very politically charged tie against the US, put him on the radar.
He started his Bundesliga career at Bochum. He joined them on loan, played 12 times, scored 3 goals, but it wasn't enough to keep them in the Bundesliga. However, this is where Hamburg pounced and made their move and signed him up.
Hamburg coach Frank Pagelsdorf parted with £2.5 million to bring the Iranian in 1999.
Yeah, and in Mehdi's first season, Hamburg would finish third in the Bundesliga, so close to that second place under Happel. Thanks in no small part to the fledging runs of their new Persian recruit. He's full of dribbles and feints along that sort of right side.
Given their status, Hamburg fans will look back on their Champions League campaign of 2001 with a lot of fondness. A famous 3-1 win over Juventus in the group stages unfortunately couldn't see them through to the next round, but Madavia looked comfortable on the continent's biggest stage alongside the likes of Tony Yeboah.
Yeah, Yeboah playing for Hamburg at this point. His first club after Leeds. Just wasn't expecting to see him crop up in here.
Things would continue to get better for the Iranian. No player made more assists in the Bundesliga in 2003 with his tally of 14. He would both be voted Hamburg and Kickers Player of the Season as Hamburg beat Dortmund 4-2 in that Liga Pokal final.
He was also named as Hamburg's Player of the Season in 2004 as well. And he later says in an interview, when 50,000 people call your name, it's an incredible feeling. And so I think he really sort of sealed his place as a proper hero at Hamburg.
Unfortunately, at this point, he was kind of reverted back to his more conservative fullback role, and his attacking exploits were definitely like numbed as he only could muster 2 goals in his final season before a move to Eintracht Frankfurt beckoned.
Only a week after hanging up his boots and retiring, he was announced as a grassroots ambassador for the Asian Football Confederation, combining his role with coaching Iran's under-17 side.
2 years later, he would set up Kia FC, Iran's first grassroots football club. He quotes, Kia FC was an idea that I had in my mind for many years that come to me while I was playing football in Germany.
He says the goal is to make sure all these kids become great players in the future and are able to make the national team proud. And what's quite nice is since then he's actually rejoined Hamburg and had 3 or 4 different roles in the academy for the under-16 team and is now assistant manager at the second team.
Ketela. Töfting. Und jetzt! Und das Tor! Mit Hilfe von Edwin van der Sar.
Jumping back to Hamburg, following up that Liga Pokal win, they also would win the Intertoto Cup in 2005 and 2007. And in all honesty, whilst doing the research for this, I didn't really know what the Intertoto Cup, I'd heard of it by name and that like many clubs had won it. But once I dived into it, all I could think of was, what the?
It does get very weird when you get into the realms of like, there's 3 winners each year and it's all very strange. But yeah, competition was a summer tournament originally conceived in 1961 as a way of generating money for football pools companies in the close season, which I never knew, which is very strange.
Feels very dodgy, like right off the bat. Oh yeah, we're going to put a tournament on for gambling purposes. But it then evolved into becoming like an alternative qualifying route for the UEFA Cup, as well as allowing teams that didn't really qualify for the Champions League or the UEFA Cup to experience European football.
The competition was taken over by UEFA in 1995. The format was both a group stage and a knockout stage, with 60 teams split into 12 groups of 5, with the 16 best teams then contesting the knockout stage, with 2-legged ties at each stage, the 2 winning finalists qualifying for the UEFA Cup. So yeah, as you can see, it's not really simple, is it?
Yeah, even when we talk through this, I'm still very confused. In 1996 and 97, just 12 group winners enter the knockout round, so a little change, with now 3 finalists advancing. Hamburg qualified for this tournament by finishing in the place directly behind the UEFA Cup spots.
I just couldn't get my head around in that system when there's like 3 finals, even the year when Hamburg win it. 2 other teams have won it as well. It's a bit strange. I think it's easier to understand not calling it a cup. It's a qualifying competition, isn't it? And 3 teams qualify, but like the way they were trying to sell it as if it is like some kind of cup. So sort of going into a bit more detail of Hamburg's win, if we put it in inverted commas, win of the Intertoto Cup. So it was Sergi Barbares who got the only goal in the first leg of the 2-legged final against Valencia. It was one of 3 finals, so the other ones were Deportivo La Coruña, who lost to Marseille, and Lens beating CFR Cluj. It's a real mixing pot of clubs again. But Barbares actually saw himself sent off in the same game after 2 yellow cards. Second leg was a dull 0-0. But once again, we've got some great names from this era. for both teams. And I'm in love with this Valencia team, just reading out the names. We got Santiago Canizares in goal, Fabio Aurelio, Roberto Ayala, David Albelda, Patrick Kluivert, Vicente, Raul Albiol, Pablo Aimar, who was one of my favourite players growing up, Carlos Marchena, a young David Villa. Like, what a team.
A stupidly ridiculous team. Even Hamburg had Daniel van Buijten, Khalid Boularus, Raphael van der Vaart and Emile Mpenza.
Boularus, famous for being a right back but wearing the number 9 shirt at Chelsea. Emile Mpenza, future Man City and Plymouth Argyle striker.
And thanks to Hamburg winning one of these three finals, they qualified for the UEFA Cup.
But, you know, UEFA keep tweaking this competition. 2006, it's changed again, and there's now an outright winner awarded rather than these previous strange three finalists.
It's even more confusing. So Hamburg outrightly this time, they weren't part of like a three-tiered, three-final winners group. They outrightly won the 2007 Intertoto Cup. So it gets even more confusing. This is when it comes back to being more like a qualifying tournament, so to speak. And then, basically, whichever team comes through the Intertoto Cup then lasts longest in the UEFA Cup, they then win the Intertoto Cup. So Hamburg advanced the round of 16 by beating FC Zurich 3-1 in aggregate, while Atletico Madrid lost to Bolton Wanderers 1-0, leaving Hamburg the only team remaining in that year's competition and therefore the winners of the Intertoto Cup.
Once again, it's like this, it's just mis-selling, is it? It's not a cup. Like, they've qualified through this thing. Hamburg, to come through the Intertoto Cup, to get to the UEFA Cup, had entered in the third round in the Central East region group with teams like Rapid Vienna, Rubin Kazan, and Kromanets Odessa.
Hamburg beat Moldovan side Dacia Shinzandu 5-1 over two legs, drawing 1-1 in Moldova and winning 4-0 in Germany. So even when they do play in these tournaments, they drew in Moldova. Because of this win over the Moldovan side, they were then granted qualification into the 2007-2008 UEFA Cup. And there, they were the last team standing from the Intertoto Cup and made it to the round of 16, being beat by Bayer Leverkusen, but regardless, they had won the 2007 Intertoto Cup.
But you could say that this sort of rough, dry patch they're on, even when they are winning silverware, it's very convoluted, confusing, and pointless. I think it's just very badly labelled, that it should never be billed as a cup.
Zusehends, alles in der Leverkusener Hälfte. Wieder Paolo Guerrero, verfolgt von Rolfes. Wieder Guerrero gegen Rolfes. Guerrero, gut gemacht. Und jetzt ist drin. Raphael van der Vaart, 80. Minute. Und jetzt haben sie noch 10 Minuten. Hier das kleine Wunder zu vollbringen.
Harking back to what we already mentioned at the beginning of the podcast when we talked about Hamburg's rivals, Hamburg and Bremen on the 22nd of March in 2009 were drawn together to contest the DFB Pokal semi-final, the first of four meetings in just 19 days.
It's crazy. Absolute boiling pot of emotions, I can imagine. En route to the competition's last four, Hamburg had beaten Ingolstadt, Bochum, 1860 Munich and Wien Wiesbaden. Werder had beaten the likes of Borussia Dortmund and Wolfsburg, but both northern sides knew that it would be Bayer Leverkusen who awaited them in the final.
In this first game, Per Mertesacker would be the fastest to react to Diego's curling free kick as it struck the woodwork. He reacted the fastest and slammed home the opener after just 11 minutes.
All this talk of Per Mertesacker and fastest reactions is throwing me off a little bit.
Did the Hamburger defence just stand still?
I mean, he had the turning circle of a 747, let's be honest. But yeah, obviously an absolute cat in the box.
The home crowd were forced to wait until just after the hour mark to celebrate a goal. The equaliser came from Olic as he turned home Guy Demel's wayward strike past Tim Weiss to complete a swift counter and bring back parity in the tie.
That's when the goals ceased and it was left to penalties. So there's two spectacular saves from Weiser, but in between that, Mesut Ozil and Torsten Frings tucked away their penalties.
Meaning when Janssen's shot hit the post, it eliminated his side, and all that was left for Tim Weiss to do was to sprint the length of the field, leap the advertising boardings and celebrate with the what was the single vibrating corner triumphantly with the Werder fans.
I mean, just dumped out your arch rivals out the Pokal on their own ground to go to the final is great. And they would actually go on to win the final, Werder Bremen, 1-0 against Leverkusen with Mesut Ozil getting the only goal of the game.
However, 8 days later, Hamburg had the chance for revenge, and this time it was in the first leg of the UEFA Cup and also a semi-final.
Hamburg got to this point by getting their way past Nijmegen, Galatasaray, Man City, all of which came after topping a very eclectic group with Ajax, Aston Villa, MSK, Žilina and Slavia Prague.
The only goal of the game would come from a single back post header from Peter Trukowski, which grazed the fingertips of Tim Weiser on its way into the back of the Bremen net. And this was sufficient to see Hamburg leave the Weiserstadion as winners.
So we're two games down, one each basically here. But 7 days later, they come together again to do the second leg of the UEFA Cup to decide basically which team Germany's sending to the final in Istanbul. 13 minutes in, Olic, that man again, dinks a panicked Weiser to put his side in the lead.
Bremen struck back, Diego performing his best Olic impression in towing a cute shot over the diving Frank Rost. First half ended with both sides drawing one each.
And then a great name coming up here. So on the 66th minute, Claudio Pizarro, Bremen legend, receives the ball just beyond the halfway line with few alternatives ahead of him. He shoots and scores a great goal.
And then, in the 83rd minute, came the game's most infamous moment. The most infamous moment of the season, and perhaps the most infamous moment of any game spanning almost a near century of Nord derbies.
It's a crazy moment, which I think is one of those where it's like, depending on what side you're, you don't know whether to laugh or cry or anything. Basically, Hamburg centre-back has the ball, plays a pretty routine pass back to his goalkeeper, and as the goalkeeper attempts to pass the ball, it hits a small, balled up little bit of like paper on the pitch, which makes the ball bobble up and hit his shin and go out for a corner, which obviously was completely avoidable. And you just know what's coming from this corner, don't you?
The Dane would sigh and look confused as his teammates shrug his arms and kick this little ball, this little orb, off the field. His bemused frustration was quickly compounded and then morphed into misery when Diego's corner was flicked on by Hugo Almeida, another great name, and turned in by the stooping header of Frank Baumann.
Hamburg would score again, of course, Olic, to keep them in the hunt. It glances in a cross from Boateng, but it just wouldn't be enough.
Just as they had in the DFB Pokal semi-final only 2 weeks before, Die Grünen Weißen turned their Volksparkstadion stand into an impromptu dance floor.
And before the evening came to an end, journalist and television presenter Oliver Welke would allegedly take it upon himself to go onto the pitch and grab the infamous ball of paper which had been thrown onto the pitch by Hamburg fans before handing it to the celebrating Werder manager Klaus Allofs. The ball of paper would eventually find a home in a little presentation box on a little green plinth and put into Werder Bremen's museum or Wuseum.
So that's 3 of 4 games down, and just 3 days later, Martin Jol took his HSV team to Bremen one last time. With only 4 games left remaining in the Bundesliga, his side found themselves 5th with just 5 points off the Bundesliga leaders Wolfsburg.
Yeah, so you've got to think at this point, Bremen have ruined the Pokal party. They've ruined any potential UEFA Cup party. And now, can they put the nail in the coffin of the Bundesliga potential party as well, outside chance of maybe winning the league? So basically, Hamburg need to win this game to keep any sort of vague title hopes alive. Bremen, on the other hand, are in 10th with not a great deal to play for, just pride and keeping up this great record of derbies over the last few days. But pride alone would be sufficient, and 2 goals in 15 minutes from Hugo Almeida again would leave Hamburg without a hope in the title race. What a horrid time to be a Hamburg fan that must have been.
We're sorry to have to talk about it, but just like with the little ball of paper and then the fact that it's like held as this like jewel in the crown for Werder Bremen is just like, it's such an amazing story. We couldn't not tell it.
It's proper football shithousery to then have it in the museum. I feel like if any Hamburg fans have been listening with it, they would have turned off at this point now. Like, they don't want to relive this time again.
But I'm sure if in another universe, it'd been the other way around, those Hamburg fans would be delighting in that little white paper ball just as much as the Bremen fans.
Of course, of course. It's just making me think, like, I wonder what happened to the beach ball that Darren Bent shot against for Sunderland, against Liverpool. I wonder if that's in, like, a Sunderland museum somewhere, maybe.
Wenn Wiese wieder pariert oder Jansen, wie auch immer, den Ball nicht unterbekommt, ist Werder Bremen im Endspiel von Berlin. 3 Elfmeter gehalten von Team Wiese. Liebe Zuschauer, gucken Sie mal, wie der da abgeht. Den können Sie heute nicht mehr einfangen.
We'll finish with a player that we've briefly mentioned at the start and I think comes to mind when you think of Hamburg is, of course, the legend Raphael van der Vaart. A young starlet coming from that amazing talent machine Ajax have there in Amsterdam, just producing all these great players. Signed up to the academy at the age of 10. First team debut at the age of 17 in the 1990-2000 season. Being hailed as the new Johan Cruyff.
However, he did have some injuries whilst at the beginning of his time at Ajax. But come the 2003-04 season, van der Vaart was firmly an established first team player amongst the Ajax team. And just one season later, he was also named captain of the team too. Despite riding the momentum, things in Holland started to go a little bit south. Firstly, he was injured by then-teammate Zlatan Ibrahimovic whilst on international duty when Holland played Sweden. There were controversial accusations that the Swede had intentionally tried to hurt van der Vaart, which then led to the sale of Ibrahimovic to Juventus just 2 weeks later. This led to Raphael filling Zlatan's spot up top, but following the refusal to play in the wing in the Champions League match in December, he was then stripped of the team captaincy by then-manager Ronald Koeman.
Despite all this, he thoroughly impressed there, playing 117 games, scoring 52 goals, 2 league titles, League Cup as well. He was linked with Real Madrid, Man United, AC Milan. You know, and I think all the off-field sort of press and speculation and everything became a bit too much for him.
Just for a little bit of added context off the field as well, Raphael van der Vaart at this time was heralded as like the next coming of David Beckham. He was like a media starlet. Him and his wife were like the Dutch Poschenbecks.
Many eyebrows were raised when the news came through that he was moving to Hamburg for 5.5 million euros on the 1st of June 2005. And the outspoken Johan Cruyff proclaimed, "I don't know what to say about it or what Raphael van der Vaart is doing in Hamburg. It wouldn't have been thinkable 2 years ago. Obviously, things have not gone well for van der Vaart," he said.
The 22-year-old responded back to Johan saying, "When I came to Hamburg, I was welcomed with open arms and the atmosphere just felt right. I don't want people to think this is just a stepping stone for me. I want to achieve things with Hamburg." Bold to say, considering their last success of note for HSV came a year before van der Vaart was born, the Bundesliga and European Cup double in 1983. And some said the transfer was the highest profile of that of the likes of Kevin Keegan. Personally, with the off-the-field pressure, the stuff with the press, it sounds quite horrific. And to move from a capital city, the likes of Amsterdam, to a smaller city in Hamburg at the time, it would be perfect. And plus, at that point, he would be the biggest fish in the Elbe.
Yeah, and he played a massive part of Hamburg's impressive away form that season, scoring each of their first four games on the road. Yeah, and in fact, in the course of his first 1.5 seasons with the German club, they didn't lose a single match away from home while he was on the pitch. Van der Vaart finished his first season as the team's top goal scorer with 14, as Hamburg finished third in the league and won the 2005 Intertoto Cup, of course.
Raphael was given the captaincy in his second season, but struggled with injuries as HSV also struggled without him. He scored 3 goals in 3 games in the Champions League, but Hamburg were finished the group bottom and they were eliminated. Until his comeback, HSV only won 1 match in the Bundesliga all season and were in the relegation zone. They would go on to win 9 of the remaining 13 games, even beating Bayern Munich 2-1 away in Munich in that run after Raphael came back into the team, and it would see them finish in 7th.
Proper talisman when you hear that kind of stuff is crazy. And obviously that kind of form, once again, piquing the interest of Real Madrid, Valencia as well. And he's actually had his picture taken in the summer wearing a Valencia shirt, but no transfer materialised. Van der Vaart responded by saying, "I'm set to spend another season in Hamburg. We need to achieve something."
To be fair, he would perform. He would score 12 league goals as Hamburg finished 4th in the league, and whilst they would also reach the round of 16 in the UEFA Cup, winning the Intertoto Cup, as we mentioned, this season was again affected by injury as he tore his ankle ligaments out for several weeks.
Towards the end of the 07-08 season, the rumour mill keeps going on, linking him to several clubs again, especially Atletico Madrid and Juventus. Atletico Madrid make a 50 million bid for him. Hamburg reject it, and in the end, it was their crosstown rivals who get his signature instead.
Hamburg strangely would accept less money, only 13 million euros, for van der Vaart's transfer to Real Madrid, and it would be their only signing of that summer. He would leave HSV with 48 league goals and 113 league games for the Redshirts.
In his time at Real Madrid, sadly, he never managed to quite hold down a first team role and even fell out with the then manager Juan de Ramos once of Spurs. Things looked even bleaker under his next manager at Madrid, Manuel Pellegrini, and he wasn't even given a squad number until fellow Dutch teammates Wesley Sneijder, Arjen Robben and Klaas-Jan Huntelaar were all forced out of the club.
He scored his last goal for Real Madrid against Malaga on the 16th of May in 2010, but less than just 2 months later, he'd be joining Spurs for only €8 million after Jose Mourinho didn't even pick him in the squad for Real Madrid's opening game against Real Mallorca.
Gone to have a huge impact at the London club, and I loved watching him play when he was there. And just a month after he was signed, he was named the Premier League Player of the Month for October. And he'd become an instant fan favourite at White Hart Lane. Scoring twice to hold North London rivals Arsenal to a 3-3 draw, for example, is always going to make you popular, isn't it?
He ended the season as Spurs' top goalscorer in the Premier League as well, with 13 goals, nearly a quarter of Tottenham's total, also providing the most assists with 9. In his second season with Spurs, Van der Vaart achieved the highest points total in the club's Premier League history to that point. They would finish fourth as he would contribute 11 league goals in 33 games.
Yeah, and it seems strange that then Andre Villas-Boas, he's there and he brings in Moussa Dembélé, Clint Dempsey, Gylfi Sigurdsson comes into Spurs as well. All of this new midfield talent, which suddenly seriously reduces Van der Vaart's game time, and I think partly linked with injury and maybe partly linked with like Villas-Boas wanted to put his own stamp on things, maybe. But yeah, it seems strange.
However, this opened the door and gave Hamburg the opportunity to bring the Dutchman back. Raphael thanked the Spurs fans, stating, "Thanks to the best fans in England for an amazing time," as a €13 million deal was set in place. The deal was partly financed by local investor and coach Thorsten Fink. He said, "I'm delighted that Raphael van der Vaart will be playing for Hamburg again. He will be a strong addition to our team."
Yeah, and he would wear his favourite 23 number on the shirt and was announced as the club's vice-captain and showed his class with 2 assists against Borussia Dortmund, contributing to 2 crucial goals in Hamburg's narrow 3-2 win. Sadly, he'd pick up another injury that would keep him out for a few months, but was given the captaincy full-time on his return, going on to play his 100th Bundesliga match for Hamburg in a 4-1 win against Hoffenheim later that season. Hamburg would finish the 12-13 Bundesliga season in 7th place.
However, Raphael van der Vaart's stay at the club began to become a symbolic figure of Hamburg's decline. But he would go on to state, "It's been very, very nice. I've always felt totally at home here. My choice of HSV might have surprised some people, but I've always felt at home in this city and at this club. From the first to the last moment, we went through many ups and also some downs together."
A very unexpected moment after his playing career in 2019, hangs his boots up and decides to play professional darts, become a professional darts player. Then 36-year-old joins the British Darts Organisation and made his pro debut at the Denmark Open.
He competed alongside his brother Fernando, and his first taste of stepping up to the hockey was a victorious one as he beat Thomas Anderson 4-2 in the first round, but he was knocked out in the second round 4-0 by Morgus Kustinsson. Some could say after this turn of career that he would become Raphael van der Dart.
Very good.
Versucht auch hier und da mal was für die Offensive zu tun. Van der Vaart, Jarolim, Van der Vaart, jetzt mal der Abschluss, Rafa van der Vaart! Klasse Tor! Raphael van der Vaart! Viertes Spiel für den Hamburger Sportverein und sein erster Treffer im Trikot seines neuen Clubs.
So the final days of Raphael van der Vaart's career, one of Hamburg's heroes of this sort of modern era, sadly sort of coincides with Hamburg's gradual decline, like we've just spoke about, and their slide towards the second division of Germany.
As we've mentioned throughout these examples of all these players, young, old, the ability to spot talent, Hamburg would just not be able to either keep hold of these talents, or when they did get some big profits and they did get some money for them, they would just never be able to reinvest it properly, and it just began to see them stumble more and more towards, as we say, the second tier.
Yeah, there's only so many of these you can get away with, really, isn't there? Like young players in the academy, or like players they've signed for nothing and they can't keep hold of them. You can only lose so many before like it's going to start really hurting the club, isn't it?
An even greater example is the club's most expensive signing, Filip Kostic. Currently, he's had a spectacular season with Eintracht Frankfurt, with 4 goals and 15 assists, linking up beautifully with silver there as Frankfurt fought for European spots. Oh, what could be for Hamburg?
Another player who's left Hamburg, gone on to have also a very good, very respectable Bundesliga career is Jonathan Tah as well, the big centre-back for Leverkusen, who he made his debut for Hamburg. He's Hamburg born and bred, played half the games of that Bundesliga season, arguably the club's best defender that season. Before then, new arrivals came in, people like Johan de Jure, who's played for Arsenal, forced him out on loan to second tier Fortuna Dusseldorf.
At the end of his successful loan, Tah was then shipped off to Bayer Leverkusen, with just 2 weeks later, he has since established himself as a formidable centre-back. And Bayer Leverkusen seem to have made a habit of pinching Hamburg's rising stars when it comes to Hyunmin Heung-min Son, Jonathan Tah, and now even Kerim Derumabai. I mean, he became an integral part of the team's fourth place finish.
That's just two more really good examples of what we were saying just a minute ago, of like, you can only survive so long when you keep letting these like good young players go and things. It's gonna catch up with you at one point, and boy, does it catch up on them.
To put into perspective how proud Hamburg were of their never-ending state in the top flight, the club had the Stadion Uhr, which was a digital clock in the home of the Volkspark Stadion that counted every second they had been in the Bundesliga since the 24th of August in 1963. Wow.
It's bold having this clock, but you make yourself such an easy target for when you do get relegated, because fans had a field day with this, didn't they?
Definitely. It was so important to the club that they even had a small version of the clock mounted in the front of the team bus for away games. But the seconds would finally start to run out, as we say about these players just leaving and them slowly sliding towards the second tier.
From then, they sort of turned, and the club went from this proudly colossal beast of a football club and to just being surrounded by embarrassing chaos, really.
German football pundit Raphael Hollickshein states, "I think it's important to understand that this is not just a team doing badly, but Hamburg had gone from being one of the best clubs in Germany to being a regular laughingstock. It's not just that they had a bad season or one or two bad seasons. They were continually making mistakes both on and off the field."
Fair play to Renny Adler, the Hamburg goalkeeper at the time, who after a 5-1 defeat to Hoffenheim at home came out and said, "I feel sorry for the supporters who had to pay to watch this shit."
And even when they were getting a pounding from Hoffenheim, you've always got the big brother of the Bundesliga, that is Bayern Munich. And they just had some horrific times against the lads from Bavaria.
Yeah, it is borderline abuse when you read some of these scorelines. So since 2010, Hamburg had played Bayern Munich 19 times in the Bundesliga and DFB Pokal. So Hamburg conceded 71 goals, scoring just 7 in return, and only collected 2 points. Some of the scoreline, it's just, yeah, I feel bad reading this out. You've got a 5-0, a 6-0, a 9-2, an 8-0, and another 8-0, and the last game in 17-18 season, 6-0.
After one of the 8-0 defeats to Bayern Munich, they even had to go ahead and hire a psychotherapist to help deal with the defeats, almost like it was like PTSD or some form of trauma.
I'm just imagining like Ivica Olic like rocking under the shower, like cold shower, terrified. It is brutal, isn't it? And like, as Raphael Honigstein says, these weren't games, these were more like executions.
There's quite a funny saying that I've heard banded around by a lot of fans of teams, not just Hamburg, about playing Bayern Munich in the Bundesliga, saying that playing Bayern Munich is like going to the dentist. You have to go twice a year. You don't really want to go, and it's probably going to hurt.
Yeah, and I think all of this just brings into contrast how far they've gone from being an equal footing with Bayern, if not in some points the better team, and coming a team that's just not remotely taken seriously.
And when you're getting beaten so badly by the likes of Bayern Munich and by the likes of the teams you're aspiring to be, this kicks into overgear, as mentioned before, the merry-go-round behind the scenes. Since 2010, they've had 19 different managers.
That is an incredible stat. 19, like, I don't even think Watford have had that many. It's crazy. And of course, the problem when you are chopping and changing managers like this and there's no real identity behind the football club, you've got, you know, one guy coming in who wants to play possession football, one wants to play counter-attacking, pressing football. So there's no system coming through from the youth team to the first team. There's not like a style, a tactic that's been worked on. They're not buying players for a system. It's just revolving door. Some guy comes in, I want these 5 players, doesn't work. Some other guy comes in, I want these 6 players. It's just an absolute mess at this point.
It's probably one of the reasons why, even when they were doing so well and saving all this money, it's probably getting spent in all the wrong players once they were chopping and changing between managers. There was even instances where there was fans versus players. For example, Raphael van der Vaart and the players were attacked with eggs by Hamburg fans, going on to state, "Attacking players is not the point. Not the point at all," he told Bild. He goes on to state, "We, the players, were afraid of the fans. This is particularly difficult for the younger players. I played bad. We all played badly. We are not doing this on purpose. We must try and reach a turning point on the pitch." And it ended up with one of the unknown players crying after the attack, which, after you've already had to deal with the trauma of losing to Bayern Munich 8-0, I feel like this, on top of it, is just compounding the problems.
Probably brought up those memories again, yeah. It's pretty bleak, isn't it, at this point? When you've got the fans, like, whether you can say rightly or wrongly, like, putting this kind of pressure and negativity on the team, and obviously this goes into the players' minds, and then they take this into training, and this boiled over in one incident when Austrian Michael Gregorich slid in for a tackle on Ivo Ilisavic, and the Croatian instantly getting up and headbutting Gregorich in front of teammates and staff. Bruno Labbadia, who's the manager at the time, said, "We had an emotional training session from the very start. One incident went beyond that."
It's quite funny when you delve into the story behind that as well, because at first it's just kind of like, oh, it's a bust up in the changing room, which kind of happens in all football clubs. You hear that at big clubs, small clubs, international teams, loads of places. But then when you read that he literally was headbutting his fellow teammate, it's just like, ouch.
To top all of that off, Hamburg, we've had disastrous results, players fighting in training, fans, you know, doing whatever to the players. Now we're going to have a proper scandal now as well. Welcome to Backpackgate.
Backpackgate started when Peter Knabel, who was the sporting director, lost his rucksack. He went to the park in Hamburg and left his backpack on a bench. It was full of secret documents, contracts, all this type of stuff. So it was pretty much a treasure trove of Hamburg information.
Basically, a geriatric nurse, Alexandra D, we'll refer to her as, she found the contents of the backpack scattered on a lawn in the park near the Elbe River at the end of July. And it included, like you say, salary lists for players, like different professionals, office people at the club, documents from the scouting department, Peter Knabel's driver's license, check cards and keys as well. So like even his personal effects as well.
Shockingly, the incident turned into a criminal investigation. An anonymous email has now basically said that Miss D has now been suspected of stealing the case from Peter Knabel's car. The case was handed over to the Hamburg public prosecutor, with Hamburg's director trying to cover up his own tracks by saying, "I'll put on my steel helmet. The police should do everything to investigate. I just want to make sure that everything is completely cleared up."
The newspaper Bild at the time said there's still a few questions that are left. For example, why were there no signs of braking in his car? And also, more to the point, I'm thinking, why would this nurse, why would she steal this? Of all things, player contracts and scouting records. It's all very strange, isn't it?
And it goes one better as well, with the story being told from a Hamburg fan, basically saying, someone ended up finding it. She even rang the number on the documents, which got her to the HSV like service centre or their inside phone number. Someone at the centre asked, "Who are you?" She then explained, "I've got a bag full of papers which have HSV on them and it looks like contracts." Of course, then the guy on the other end at HSV didn't believe her and just hung up. She then rang up the newspapers and said, "I've got this backpack," and from then it just went wild.
When we're just saying like this club is already a laughing stock, to then have like such a huge like gaffe like this, it's just embarrassing, isn't it? Next thing you know, on the front page of Bild was the headline, "HSV Gehaltsliste im Park gefunden," simply meaning HSV payroll found in the park. Laughingstock once again.
Ridiculous. Raphael Hoogstein even goes on to mirrors Mark's comments there when he said that it was symptomatic of just how gaffe-prone Hamburg had become.
The off-field situation now is just as embarrassing as the on-field performances, with your 9-2 losses to Bayern Munich. And they're just managing to find a way to stay in the top division over and over again, with like a writer at the time saying, "Hamburg are so bad, they can't even go down." Like,
so right now we're about to jump through just some, quickly, some of the seasons, how close they were to going down, some of the close calls, some of the matches, some of the relegation playoffs they ended up in. So we'll kick off in the 2011-2012 season, in which, when you see that they were 5 points clear of the drop zone, you might be thinking, oh, that's not bad, that's not bad. But it's quite funny to see that we found a Hamburg fan who was like, oh, that was a bad season, but it wasn't really shit.
Yeah, and then moving on to the 13-14 season, Hamburg then finished in the relegation playoff spot and faced Greuther Fürth. And after drawing 0-0 at home, it was a 1-1 draw away that kept in the Bundesliga on away goals. And I think that Hamburg fan would now agree that was really shit.
Little did they know, though, the next season it wasn't going to get any better. Bruno Labbadia, their fourth manager of the season, saved the club at the end of the 14-15 season in a relegation playoff for the second year running against Karlsruhe SC.
Yeah, so this is 2 years in a row now in the relegation playoffs and 2 years avoiding it. Like, if this isn't a wake-up call, I don't know what is. And this really went down to the wire as well. And so in the second leg, Marcelo Diaz for Hamburg killed in a free kick from 18 metres over the wall into the top left corner. And this put the game basically back on a level playing field with seconds left. It goes to extra time. Nikolai Müller scores to make it 2-1 with 5 minutes left in extra time. And Rowan Hennings even had a chance to equalise, but René Adler saved his penalty in a very dramatic end to the game, and Hamburg would win 3-2 on aggregate.
On the last match day of the 16-17 season, Hamburg avoided the relegation playoffs, so progress, maybe, and stayed in the Bundesliga once again by just 1 point, thanks to a Luca Waldschmidt winner against Wolfsburg at the Volksparkstadion.
He's done well to keep that in, Kostic. There's the header that's going to save Hamburg from the relegation. Everyone's on the pitch. And Hamburg may just save themselves from the ignominy that is the playoff. How important is that goal going to be for Luca Waldschmidt on his birthday, plus one?
Yeah, but they would finally run out of luck in the 17-18 season, so this is the end of Hamburg in the Bundesliga. Yeah, and they actually started quite brightly, two wins back-to-back, but then they got eight games without a win, and things are starting to look pretty hopeless. Hamburg fans actually unveiled a banner which said, "Before the clock stops, we will chase you through the city." Yeah, so the atmosphere, as you can tell, once again, is pretty toxic.
They lost in the first round of the DFB Pokal to third tier side Unterbrück, and at the end of the first half of the season, HSV were second last in the table.
After two defeats in the first two games of the second half of the season, coach Marcus Gisdol was dismissed. Hamburg hired Bernd Hollerbach, but after 7 games without a win and a 6-0 defeat, he was also dismissed, so things are just chaotic as fuck here right now. And then a few days before the game against Bayern, the club announced the dismissal of the CEO, Herbert Bruckhagen. So now you've fired two managers, the CEO's gone. Then Frank Wettstein, who was the CFO at the time, is now appointed the new CEO. And on the first day of his appointment, he then fires the sports director, Jens Tott. But you can feel the panic is really setting in now. Like, this is a very chaotic atmosphere of just everybody's firing each other.
Against all odds, they won 3 out of the last 4 games to somehow give themselves hope going into the last game of the season at home versus Borussia Mönchengladbach.
The players who achieved those 3 wins out of those last 4 games need some serious credit, even though they went down, when they've got this absolute circus around them where "You're fired. No, you're fired. You're fired." It reminds me of this scene on Peep Show when it's like, "Are you trying to section me?"
The situation relied on needing already beaten Köln to beat Wolfsburg on the final day.
The Hamburg fans welcomed the team bus with their vast support. And on the 71st minute, they were actually beating Mönchengladbach 2-1. However, back in Cologne, Wolfsburg were winning 3-1. And all of a sudden, the people in the stadium realised that their impending fate and doom was coming. And the thing they thought was impossible was, yeah, becoming a reality right in front of their eyes.
The scenes at the Volksparkstadion, as this became a reality, are apocalyptic at points, as they were throwing smoke bombs onto the pitch. Banners were being set on fire and a huge grey plume of smoke covered most of the Nordtribüne. The players were forced off the pitch, and the police had to create a line of opposition about along the halfway line, just looking at this fiery plume of smoke as it billowed into the air.
Yeah, the Volkspark Stadion is becoming a bit of a war zone at this point. Yeah. Just to rub salt in the wounds even more, like what we said earlier, like this clock, you know, it makes you an easy target, and especially when something like this happens. And Borussia Mönchengladbach fans, you know, fair play. They revealed their own TIFO in the stand, which was just like the Hamburg clock, the Stadion hour, which counted down from the hour, then minutes, then seconds of the little time Hamburg had left in the Bundesliga before they joined every other team in Germany inexperienced in second division football.
It's official. Hamburg are relegated from the Bundesliga for the first time in their history. They've narrowly avoided this moment in recent years, skating on ice and dancing around the drop until now. Fate has finally caught up with them. They'll have to stop the clock at the Volksparkstadion.
And down they went, unfortunately. As it was stated in the papers afterwards, Der Dino of the Bundesliga has faced their own extinction.
Yeah, 54 years and 261 days, and they're in the second division. And they were the last founding club of the Bundesliga to taste this heartbreak of relegation and spend time in the second division. And
for context, the likes of Borussia Dortmund, Mönchengladbach, even the mighty Bayern Munich have all spent time in the lower tiers. So it is amazing that they managed to hang on for so, so long.
Especially that run of seasons before it where the two relegation playoffs in a row, like surviving by 1 point, having like 4 or 5 managers in a season, it was inevitable by this point, wasn't it? And sometimes I think at that point, it's just put them out of their misery. They stop this ongoing soap opera every season.
So with the mighty HSV now in Bundesliga 2, you would think a club the size of their magnitude, the huge resources they have, they'd be favourites to come straight back up and get fighting back in the Bundesliga. Since 2014, they'd spent a massive €121 million on players, according to Transfermarkt, which easily dwarfs that of many sides down in the second tier. However, even the 1920 season, they fought bravely, leaving it with a draw being enough to get a promotion playoff against northern rivals Werder Bremen, and a draw at home against Sandhausen, a bottom half club from a village in the southwest of Germany with a population of 15,000 people, being enough to hopefully get them back up into that first tier.
Talk about being brought back down to earth with a bang. A shocking 5-1 defeat follows to Sandhausen, which the club's English Twitter account actually described as embarrassing, which it really is. To rub salt in the wounds, the scorer of the fifth goal, Dennis Diekmeyer, played for Hamburg for 8 years amid 184 appearances without scoring a single goal.
Considering in that same season, Stuttgart followed Hamburg down into the second tier and they immediately bounced back. And have followed that up now with an impressive campaign back in the Bundesliga, nestled nicely in mid-table.
Shows how a club of that size and stature should be able to come down and bounce back up, because Hamburg, it's not a case of a club that goes down and then they're in financial turmoil, they have to sell everybody, and they should be bouncing back, they should do. And
at the time of writing, in the Bundesliga 2, the 2020-21 season, it's come to a close and Hamburg have finished in fourth place, oh so close, only being one spot away from that promotion playoff.
Yeah, they finished 4 points behind playoff contenders Holstein Kiel. And despite thumping Braunschweig 4-0 on the final day, it was in fact the 3-2 loss to Osnabrück on the penultimate match day that actually sealed their fate in the second tier for another year.
The personnel merry-go-round is still in effect too, with having two managerial changes in the last season. Dieter Hecking was replaced with Daniel Tehun, only for him to be sacked with 3 games to go and for HSV legend Horst Huberisch to come in on an interim basis.
The legend is back in the building, but sadly couldn't get Hamburg over the line this time. Striker Simon Terodde was actually leading the race for the Golden Boot for a chunk of the season with 23 goals and 5 assists, but has signed a pre-agreement to join another huge club, joining Hamburg back in the second tier, which is Schalke.
And one personal positive from the team was Tim Leibold, who clocked up the most amount of assists in Bundesliga 2 last season. This is even mentioning that their North German rivalries Werder Bremen will also be joining them in the second tier as well. HSV will be able to play both the Nord Derby and the Stadt Derby in the second tier next year.
Yeah, I think Bundesliga 2 next season is going to be really worth following, because you've got Schalke down there, Bremen, Hamburg as well. But like you say, we've got the Nord Derby and the Stadt Derby in there. It's going to be quality.
It's also worth mentioning that we've still got massive club Hannover 96, who just finished in mid-table as well in Bundesliga 2. And then you've got the likes of Dynamo Dresden with a huge support, and Hansa Rostock, another huge club, coming up as well. So Bundesliga 2 is going to be well worth a watch, and we're going to be following it, no doubt about that.
Some good away days in there, I think.
I think Hamburg fans can take a little bit of solace by the fact that they're going to be able to relive these actual derbies full time in the second tier next year.
It's got to be exciting to have the derby back, and at least that's something the fans can really get behind. But also, I think it must be quite worrying knowing the quality we've just spoke about that's going to be in Bundesliga 2 next season. Even more competition for those promotion spots. But yeah, well worth a watch.
And then, in the dying seconds of the game, Diaz scoring his first goal of the season, his first ever goal for Hamburg. With literally seconds to spare, Hamburg had clawed themselves back into the Bundesliga.
And coming to the end of what is the story of Hamburg now, to conclude, a really great quote that we found was, "Hamburg are a slumbering giant who have sleptwalked off the cliff and into the depths of their domestic pyramid."
You only have to look at teams like Kaiserslautern, who had actually announced they'd be filing for insolvency when they're in the third division. You've got 1860 Munich and others. Like, this is what can happen to these fallen giants who find themselves trapped in this downward spiral, financial mismanagement, and a poor running of the club, poor transfer strategy and things, and you can really get stuck down there. And even when you saw like Dresden going down to like the third division the other year, like luckily Hamburg seemed to be still sort of hovering around those top promotion spots, but they just need this final push to get them back.
Fingers crossed for them. As Hamburg professor and sports economist Wolfgang Manning states, the scenario is already a huge open wound for the city.
Yeah, and it'd be great to see them back in the Bundesliga, wouldn't it?
We'll have our fingers crossed for them.
See Van der Vaart come back as like manager or something.
Well, we've already predicted Steven Gerrard, so.
Yeah, and I think the end of the episode now brings us to our now traditional closing link to the next episode. We got some feedback last time that our very niche link from Blackpool to Hamburg was maybe a little bit too niche, unless you was a keen follower of Barry Bannon's career. I'm sure Barry Bannon and his family would have got it. So this time we've made it a little bit easier, and the clue is, it's already been mentioned in this episode, Hamburg faced off against this team in the 1983 UEFA Super Cup, and unfortunately losing 2-0. So do go back and let us know who you think it is. I'll take a wild guess at, you know, one of the teams you can remember.
So apart from that, we'd just like to say thanks for listening. Make sure to drop a like, make sure to share, as everything you do helps the podcast grow, as well as also giving us maybe like a rating on Apple Podcast, helps with all the algorithms and all that type of stuff as well. But apart from us, from here at The Journeyman, I'm Joseph Corlett.
I'm Mark Reeves.
And that's everything. Goodbye.
See you next time.